Blog Talk Radio.
He's 5'2", and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's on 31, and he's only 17. A soldier for a thousand years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist, and a Baptist, and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting in Canada, he's fighting in France, he's fighting in the USA, and he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way, and he's fighting for democracy, or fighting for the red, he says it's for the peace of all. Die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Dachau? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon in a war. And without him, all this killing can't go on.
Happy Thanksgiving. Lorraine and I had my mom over for dinner today. Mom's 97 years young and doing great. We had a Skype call with the Jackson Mott Clark reunion held this year in Muncie, Indiana. Mom's a Mock, only one left in her generation. She's the oldest in our extended tripartite family. I think this was the 145th reunion, nearly a year missed, since some soldiers on opposite sides of the Civil War got together to share fellowship and goodwill and renew family ties. I'm proud to be part of the tradition. Wish I could have been there in person, but it was great visiting by this video chat, kind of like attending vicariously. Those reunions, when I was growing up, made Thanksgiving one of my favorite holidays. And it's fared better than most other holidays in my adult life. I still look forward to it. I love the food. I really respect the meaning of the day, to give thanks for what you have, give help to those who need it. My mom ate three helpings of my scalloped oysters and did quite well with the turkey soup. We had soup because we'd made our turkey a while back. I might even have talked about it last week. But I'd saved enough of the soup so that we could share it with mom today and made the scalloped oysters just special. For her to eat this much is, I'll tell you, it's the biggest compliment I can think of. Last year, about this time, I think she was down to 70 pounds. Eating is a real big thing for her. Like I said, Thanksgiving's one of my favorite holidays. I don't think of it in terms of the British invaders that lorded it over Native Americans preparatory to stealing their lives or livelihood. That's not the historical tradition that I think of. Think of this tradition of my family. Think of those foolishly dedicated men who took some time out from a horrible war, arguably the first modern war, maybe the first war to end all wars. And people took time out to worship together and to value peace, friendship, and family beyond governments and ideologies. Mom, at 97, doesn't always hear exactly what was said. Her mind makes up its own interpretation of the sound. Sometimes she realizes it and plays with the words a little bit. Well, you know, hey, maybe it's me that doesn't hear correctly and she gets it just right. Could be that way. And maybe none of us really hears what other people are saying. Maybe we all make it up as we go along. Might explain a lot of things. Just saying. This day, November 22nd, isn't just Thanksgiving. 49 years ago, a young and an idealistic president lost his life on this day. Many people feel that the assassination of John F. Kennedy was a huge turning point in America. It was the first time those who really run the country were bold enough to knock off their figurehead because this player had exceeded the role that they mapped out for him. Now, I'm not so sure that this very same scenario hadn't played out several times before, though. Seems like one of those historical patterns that repeats over and over. Part of the endless cycle of revolution and counter-revolution that was drummed into me back in my high school history class. You see, I was very lucky. I attended Friends Central School in Philadelphia, and I had the opportunity to learn how to think. In our history classes, which, by the way, I really hated, we were asked to analyze, not to memorize. It wasn't all about battles. The great forces that move societies and civilizations were meticulously dissected. The concepts of revolution and counter-revolution that I mentioned earlier were revealed in all their glory. And of course, those terms do not always imply a military conflict and a violent overthrow. Sometimes all it takes is an idea, a dream. Here on the New American Dream radio show, our dream is that people in America and the world can live together in peace. We dare to dream of a society where cooperation trumps competition and love triumphs over hate. And now I'm going to share some thoughts from Bill Hicks.
It's just a ride. And we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace.
And now, coming to you live from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in Duluth, Minnesota, Dreaming the New American Dream, with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Pelichek.
I'm Chuck Gregory, and this is the New American Dream radio show, and I'm proud to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Pelichek, an American writer.
Happy Thanksgiving, Chuck. Tonight we welcome special guests Michael Annis and Len Osanek. Michael is in Denver. Len is speaking to us from Vancouver, Canada. And so tonight we are gathering together for the New American Dream radio show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Vancouver, Canada, Denver, and wherever you are. It's the American dream, and you have to be asleep to believe it. Well, we don't believe it here. We don't believe in Barack Obama or the 9/11 Commission or Ronald Reagan or the U.S. military or the Warren Commission. We do believe in folks like Michael Annis and Leno Sanik and hundreds of others who, over decades, have pursued the new American dream where the people will know the truth about the history of their own country. And because of this, they will be allowed to pursue not wealth and 900 TV stations and every Jetson gadget imaginable at the cost of the lives of the people of Gaza and Iraq and El Salvador and Afghanistan, but will be allowed to pursue peace, prosperity, and good things through peace. JFK and the Unspeakable is a book by James Douglas. I waited my whole life to read James Douglas's new book back in 2008, JFK and the Unspeakable. The wait was not worth it. I should not have had to wait at all. This is supposed to be America, but it is not. That is why I was made to wait. Americans should not have to wait. We'd like to have it right now. We want what we want when we want it. Now, please. Sister Ellen walked into our third grade classroom, hands tucked neatly into the opposite brown sleeve. She was a principal at Sacred Heart Elementary, and she only came to the classrooms to announce that the poorest kid in our class and his large family had run off a bridge this morning on the way to school or lead us down to the gym for the Christmas movie and extra chocolate milk. So on November 22, 1963, when tall, lean, straight Ellen floated in just after lunch recess, you know, pre-Vatican, two sisters had no feet, legs, arms, no hair. Well, then we saw the Franciscan specter of death. Later, Mom ironed while she watched the caisson and Blackjack, the riderless horse, on the black and white television in the front room. This was Norfolk, Nebraska. The Norfolk Daily News and WJAG told us it was Oswald. We just assumed, along with the Omaha World Herald, that the Warren Commission had been commissioned by God. Hometown hero Johnny Carson grilled an actual hero, attorney Jim Garrison, because Garrison had the gall to think for himself. Then followed days and decades of lies, football on TV and lies, pot roast on Sunday with lies, turkey and dressing for Thanksgiving, white lies, dark lies. Through it all, through the fog of American cultural propaganda, some persisted, some wanted the truth, some like Oliver Stone in JFK in 1991, hit hard enough to make the ground quiver for a moment, crack in some places. But the cracks were quickly filled by volunteers with footballs, turkey dressing, cranberries, credulity. And now comes James W. Douglas, longtime peace activist, professor, Catholic worker. Why is his book the one I've been waiting for? Maybe because it's the new flood of information, at least new to me. Maybe it's the way Douglas lays it out on the line, straight and true, brick by brick, looking us in the eye and telling us it was the CIA who killed John F. Kennedy and that it was because of money, of course. Is there something else? I'm not an assassination expert. I'm an expert in living in America. I'm a PhD in suffering through America. It's propaganda, it's holiday dinners, football afternoons, coffee conversations, newspaper articles, television, news shows, entertainment shows. If there was one thing worth listening to or hearing out of all of those, there would be no need to excuse oneself to go stand in the garage smoking hidden cigarettes, holding the knife at your neck, then putting the cigarettes back into the hiding spot and the knife as well, and going back to try once more to think and live and act as an American. I happen to hold several advanced degrees in American culture, years and decades spent sitting in comfortable chairs wearing new Christmas pajamas, balancing a Jethro bowl of cherry black walnut ice cream in my lap, seeking enlightenment by watching Johnny Carson, Don Rickles, Dean Martin, Ed McMahon, and then going to bed convinced beyond any reasonable doubt there is nothing more. This is what there is. This is life. All there is to see and know is what I can see in my peripheral vision while watching Big Red Football, Gunsmoke, Mayberry RFD, Happy Days, Survivor. That is all our Norfolk High School U.S. history books, all my parents, Isabel and Malash, the parish priests and mailman have to tell us. They were my Socrates and I was their Plato, and in our daily discourse I learned not to ask certain questions. Over the years and decades I had it drilled into me the beauty and wonderment and majesty that the rain was good for the farmers and that it would get cold again this winter. In the Athens that I imagine Norfolk to be, with its Central Park band pavilion and its world's largest stockyard, which is also a lie, I learned not to learn. But now, an unknown stone falls from the sky. We dance around it like monkeys, howling, hitting it with sticks, afraid to touch it. Well, someone pick it up. What's this? There is more, a lot more. The land of the free and the home of the brave murders its own presidents when they threaten the men with the money. Oh, my. The amber waves of grain will roll right over you, your children, your house, if you stand in their path in any meaningful way. Murder Incorporated, the business of America is business, to protect and to serve. We will kill you and your sons and daughters, grandmothers, to get what we want. What we want is to eat and watch television by ourselves in the dark. While we grow wrinkles trying to figure out 2 + 2, those who have made that their profession manipulate everything. We vote and we work and we study and we worry about our children having ho-hos in their lunchbox and friends on the bus. And we pay money earned on our knees to hire men and women to kill leaders and overthrow governments, to make more money for those who built our schools and run our newspapers. And if those people also decide that our president should die, then we can do that too. And we pay to have that done, like having the carpet cleaned, the lawn mowed, the oil changed. And no newspaper or radio station or TV station will ever talk about it unless telling us that it never happened. And we will believe them, because not believing them means figuring out something else to believe. And we have things to do. We have lives to live. And those lives mean nothing, less than nothing, because they are built, constructed, days laid down unevenly, brick by brick, on lies and murder. Lies, murder, lies, killing, lies, death. And it goes on and on as if it will never stop. And then one unexpected day along comes a brave man, like those brave men murdered, who is not like the weak men with the lies, and everything changes. A revolution without guns, a cultural revolution, an undelicate purging of turkey and cranberries, a detoxification, a new enlightenment like the one that spawned the men who made this country, that the recent men have destroyed. And the time does not seem quite so long. Then and now are connected, brought together, come together, and now maybe, just maybe, our children will not live within lies, houses of lies, schools of lies, lives of lies. Just maybe. Back to you, Chuck.
Now, please join us for another episode of Carl and Buster, the last of the Paperboys. The Last of the Paper Boys is sponsored every week by the good folks at Winston Cigarettes and Wild Turkey Whiskey. Now, sit back, be quiet as we zoom in on Mount Liberty, Nebraska, and the great American westernly Midwest, somewhere between Iowa and Colorado, out on the prairie. The big grain elevators, the barbed wire fence, the cows, the corn, the newspaper carriers.
You want some gum? Carl held out the hard gum from the baseball card package.
Nah, you go ahead, said Buster. I can't chew that stuff anymore. My teeth just can't take it.
Carl folded the gum and stuck it into his mouth, perhaps more carefully than he had before. Carl and Buster sat on their Stingray bikes outside the newspaper office door, kickstands down, leaning back, lounging on their banana seats up against the sissy bar. Carl's kickstand was broken, actually. He used the parking meter for sport just as well.
Carl and Buster came to work as paper boys for the Daily News back in the early 1960s. They were both in elementary school. It was a big deal. Not every kid got hired, you know. They liked the idea of having a real job, some money they actually made on their own. They talked about how they liked the fresh smell of the ink and being up close with the whole idea of the newspaper business. They saw a reporter out covering a high school basketball game or drove past a Daily News building with relatives after the big Thanksgiving meal. They could say they worked there. And over the years, well, the other kids quit. graduated to middle school, junior high, senior high, college, got other jobs, got married, bought a big house out in the west part of town, had kids. Carl and Buster trained lots of those kids into being good paper boys, and eventually the kids of those kids as well. Young kids won't stick with it. You stay a few months, that's usually it. And they join Little League or get a better gig shoveling snow.
But Carl and Buster loved the newspapers, wished they could have been Charles Schultz or Jimmy Breslin, a big publisher, even a small one, but this was okay. This was a foot in the door, a part of the action. You get to read the news and sports first, of course. And now everyone already knew it 9 hours ago, but still, well, shoot, they're happy. And how many people can really say that?
Buster thought once or twice about leaving, getting away from Mount Liberty, doing something different. Maybe going to Omaha or Lincoln, delivering the Journal Star or the World Herald. But he didn't. In that one year, he tried to get Carl to move with him to New York City and deliver the Times or the Post. They were going to do it, too. For a whole week, they talked about how they'd ride their bikes to New York. And they thought, for another whole week, how they'd get their bikes on a bus or an airplane. And, well, then without really deciding, they just stopped talking about it. Once they got their pictures on the front page of the Daily News on Newspaper Carrier Week, sitting on their bikes, that was a big deal. Once they got their pictures on page 5, a reprint from a story in the World Herald, the oldest carriers in Nebraska. That was 12, 15, maybe 25 years ago now, seems like, maybe. Every day except Sunday, rainy, windy, snowy, sunny, they sit outside the Daily News gray steel back door and wait for the door to get unlocked. They take turns getting up and checking every 5 minutes or so. And then they go down and wait for their bundles to come down the metal chute. And they work on the big metal tables, folding their papers, putting them neatly, strategically into their cloth bags that fit over their shoulders. One gets done first, the other helps. The routes are in the same section of town, and they ride together till they get to Elm Street, then they split up.
News nerds, they call themselves. They actually have favorite editions, like some of the guys have favorite cars or football teams. Some folks know each episode of Happy Days or Gilligan's Island or the Dukes of Hazzard or the 65 Packers or the lyrics to Stairway to Heaven word for word. Carl and Buster know news. At home, on their bedroom walls, they have special ones, the best, most important papers in frames.
Reggie Jackson, 4 home runs in 4 at-bats. 1977 World Series against the Dodgers in one game. John Lennon, shot. Mount St. Helens erupts. Vietnam War ends. Packers win the Super Bowl. Again. Man on the Moon. Princess Diana killed. Bill Clinton in big trouble. The Beatles hit New York City. The United States attacked.
And both of them had smack dab center right on their bedroom doors, the Daily News front page from November 23rd, 1963. Kennedy is dead.
And neither of them knows it about the bedroom door of the other guy. And they don't ever talk about it. It's too sad. Too much. Just way too much.
Nobody reads papers anymore. The Daily News is getting thinner and thinner both ways. Everybody is on their computer or their phone. Carl tells Buster it's because the Daily News doesn't tell the truth. Never did.
Buster doesn't believe that, won't listen to it, so Carl doesn't bring it up very often, maybe once a decade. But it's the truth, he says. They don't tell the truth about Oswald or Waco or Oklahoma City, JFK, RFK, MLK, or Wellstone, 9/11 or Iraq, or the moon. None of that. So people just know the only thing they tell the truth about is ninth grade football.
Buster says that's probably enough. You can only go so far, and then that's far enough. It is nice to not have such heavy papers, easier on the back, especially when a guy gets older. But it makes Carl and Buster wonder about how long they'll have their jobs, be able to go out, help the other guy go collect after dark with their punches and flip cards and heavy canvas pouches, and then be able to go spend a quarter or dollar down at the Dairy Queen before having to get home. They talk about getting other jobs, but who would hire them? All they know is the paper biz. And so they decide to stay without ever really saying it.
They throw their paper bags stained with ink, strawberry ice cream, and cherry Coke over their heads, pedal down the street. They ride with no hands down the middle of the street till they see a car coming. They ride past all the people who know them, waving, honking, smiling at them like they were in a parade. One of them once said to the other that the worst thing in the world would be if they stayed their whole life in this one place, this one town, this one job. The other said, that sounded like the best thing to him.
And now they probably don't remember who said what or that it ever came up. At Fifth and Elm, they swerve apart like skiers who take different paths down the hill for a while, knowing they'll meet up at the end.
See ya, says Buster.
See you later, hollers Carl, pulling on the butterfly handlebars to stand up to pedal, then letting himself back down slowly.
Tune in next week for Tales of the Paper Boys, when we hope we'll hear Buster say, what was that?
And Carl responds, I didn't hear anything, did you? Our first guest tonight is Michael Annis. Michael Annis is the last of the real American publishers who produces books out of love for the power of the finely crafted words and pages. One of the books Michael produced was Cost of Freedom, which told the stories of dozens of American peace activists struggling against the Bush administration, against apathy, against bloodlust, against ignorance. We've been talking about Cost of Freedom over the past few months because simply the struggle continues. And the struggle is relevant especially today because it was on November 22nd, 1963, 49 effing years ago, that the corner was turned when the powers, the actual evil empire, put their work into high gear in their quest for taking over America and the world. Michael, it is again our pleasure to have you as a guest on the New American Dream. Happy Thanksgiving and welcome.
Yeah, hi, Mike. Happy Thanksgiving to you, too.
What, take it away, Mike, whatever you got for us.
Okay, well, I've been listening a little bit to you, to the program, and I think that I kind of like to start with this last election. Just a few comments on that. It's like watching a Romney and Obama debate was like watching two corporations debate, and the condescending deceiver corporation against the affable betrayer corporation. But the only real winner in the contest was going to be corporate interests. And we the people are the doting serfs and inmates of overlords who control and corral us in our third world nation, the serfs and inmates. So the 99 percenters now are as much a third world nation as the indigenous people of Pine Ridge. So we were talking earlier about obfuscation and deceit by governments toward people that they govern, those people that they govern. You know, and it's the same mentality, the same willful strategy that obfuscated the Kennedy assassinations, the disposal of Martin Luther King Jr., the imposition of Reagan into office, and the engineering of all future elections to give only a choice between corporate candidate A and corporate candidate B, and the near complete elimination of any candidate that actually challenges the problems. And the main problem is corporatocracy, and has been for decades. So it's deception and obfuscation by the oligarchies who've united in stamping out their own people until they are the only ones left, and they will fight for possession of every last dollar or yen or ruble or pound or franc, and for every last drop of oil and every last scrap of whatever wealth remains. And here's the thing. They try to contextualize it in with the idea of it being some kind of a movie script, and it's not a movie script. They want us to relate to this as if it were a movie script, where, you know, at the end the good guys come out on top and the world is safe from plummeting into the abyss of catastrophic climate desolation or abject universal poverty or whatever it may be. But that is not how the movie will end, because it isn't a movie. And no amount of power, and particularly that of religious-based organizations, no matter what religion we're talking about, no amount of power will change the course of the what I call the anti-movie, which is the reality we choose to ignore and negate. The script of the anti-movie, the pseudo-drama, has turned to the obfuscation of climate change, for example. And one of the examples I would like to give is the idea of building levees, dikes around New York City and Eastern Seaboard, rather than planning mass evacuation plans before the imminent desolation that's to come. So that those citizens could actually be saved. And here's the thing. Rather than perish in the cages that are erected by a corporate government, the government should be informing people of the degree, the place in time in history which the human race stands, and they should be informing us to the point where they are proposing options and allowing other people who are intelligent, perceptive individuals to come up with options and solutions. But they don't do that. They try to give us the old, it's almost like a football game, where if you cheer loud enough, your team will win. And it's all a construct of fantasy. So when people are getting out to protest, I think it's very important that they understand that this is reality, and this is not a game, and it is not a movie script. And there's no guarantee in this movie script that it's going to end well. That whatever it is that we do, we have to act now. And we have to act with complete and total resolve. And we have to stop listening to those who would intentionally distort the truth and manipulate the people in order to bring about their particular ends rather than the good of the people. So I was thinking about this, and I started researching a little bit, what do people have to say about revolution and about rebellion? In other words, about ferreting out the truth so that one can, ferreting out the lies so that one can bring about the truth. So Vladimir Lenin said, I'm going to quote him, "It's impossible to predict the time and progress of revolution. It is governed by its own more or less mysterious laws. But when it comes, it moves irresistibly." Now, I'm thinking about what's going on with Walmart employees right now. And I'm strongly encouraging listeners of New American Dream to support the strikers, Walmart strikers, and boycott going to Walmart to purchase their, you know, whatever it is they think they need to purchase from that place on Black Friday, which is tomorrow. To stand in solidarity with these people, because I know for a fact, I've had friends who've worked at Walmart for years, I know for a fact that they are taking a huge risk, because this is just one more gigantic scumbag corporation, and they don't care anything about their employees. All they care about is their profit. So, What does another Lennon say? John Lennon said, all you need is love, and all we are saying is give peace a chance. Then Karl Marx said, the history of all hitherto existing society is a history of class struggles. Oppressor and oppressed stood in constant opposition to one another, a fight that each time ended either in a revolutionary reconstitution of society at large or in the common ruin of the contending classes. Another Marx, Groucho Marx, said, time wounds all heals. Politics is the art of looking for trouble, finding it everywhere, diagnosing it incorrectly, and applying the wrong remedies. Well, it sounds comic, except that that's exactly what's going on. They aren't proposing anything to us that is even a credible solution anymore, because they're trying to obfuscate the immensity of the problems that are now at work in the world, whether it's climate or economics, social engineering of some kind, whatever it might be, militarism, wars. They are trying to obfuscate the real problems. So I say, when the workers of Walmart gain enough courage and momentum, as they have at this moment in time, to strike against the beast of corporatism, it offers much more for us than a decision to support or not support them, the common man, or to engage in politics as usual. Rather, it offers all of us a small frame in the movie of history to take back from Moloch the Beast a little bit of what belongs to us, and to try to ensure that this beast does not gain control, complete control of society again. So that's essentially my thoughts, preliminary thoughts. Now, if I have a little bit of time, I'm not sure how much time I've taken already, but if I have a little bit of time, I'd like to read from Cost of Freedom, an excerpt back in the early 2000s, three nuns performed an action at a missile silo in northern Colorado, and they were summarily arrested. I wrote a poem about it. I'm not going to read that poem, but what followed after their arrest were protests, where a unified group of people from all over Colorado and other elsewhere got together and held actions, protests at all of the missiles. There's like 49 missile silos out in this area, out in the prairies, northeast of Denver and in Wyoming and in Nebraska. But what I would like to read from Cost of Freedom is part of a sentencing statement from one of those peace nuns. Her name is Ardith Platte. And she says, and this is printed in the book, with a vision for disarmament, a mandate to speak truth, and a mission to halt the sinfulness, illegality, and criminality being touted in my name, I march to the drummer of my soul, who instills faith rather than fear, trust, not hopelessness, and love instead of hatred and enemy relationships made through endless threats, innuendos, propaganda, and permanent war making. This journey has included numerous direct actions over decades, forums, vigils, lobby, processions, demonstrations, boycotts, and civil resistance in various areas of the country. Our social analysis, along with the need to unmask urgent and sometimes secretive matters, has led me into nonviolent symbolic public actions of resistance. Sisters Carol, Jackie, and I believe that we had a responsibility to inspect, expose, and symbolically disarm this weapon of mass destruction to avert a crime of our government and uphold the laws of the United States, not break them. Don't people claim today that the citizens of Germany should have blocked the trains carrying people to the crematoriums, dismantled the ovens, or done something to stop the mass murder of people by Hitler? Well, how will future generations judge all of us. Could peacemakers' lives be that expendable? Will the punitive measures taken against dissenters, enforced under Patriot Bills 1 and 2, be so harsh that any lawlessness on the part of government officials will go unchallenged in the future? Who will be courageous enough to reveal the lies and stop the murderous conduct in Afghanistan and Iraq? Who will demand an end to U.S. interventionism? Who will stand in behalf of the people contaminated by depleted uranium? Who will be there for prisoners illegally detained in Guantanamo? Who will teach the treaties and U.S. Constitution, and who will demand the implementation by every court of the land? Who will bring nonviolence into the forefront for conflict solving? I find the charges in the Sacred Earth and Space Plowshares too bogus. Ours was a simple, measured, nonviolent, symbolic action wherein the liturgical rituals were crystal clear. What were the fears within the prosecutor to call for an emotion that silenced us all, the laws so pertinent to the threats to use the Minuteman III? What fears were within the judge to grant the silencing? Being stripped of our law defenses made the trial a farce. The elements of the charges were not substantiated beyond a reasonable doubt by the prosecutor. The jury did not recognize the ongoing change in the wording of the charges throughout the trial. Okay, so I'm going to end it there. But all that to say that when one does get out and perform these actions, these protests, and when one is apprehended, don't expect a government that continually obfuscates, misrepresents the truth, to, in fact, handle, if you're finally brought to trial for this, if you're arrested and brought to trial, don't expect them to treat you as if you do have rights. Because the whole thing now is set up for the rule of the many by the very, very few. And it is rule. It's as much of a serf system as there ever was. And we have to kind of look at it like that. And I would encourage people to continue. Like I say, tomorrow is the action against Walmart's treatment of its employees, to stand with those people and to remember that this is a window of opportunity in history that we have to take this stand. And perhaps from there we can incite others to essentially take back what belongs to us.
Michael, thank you very much. In closing, could you tell people again how they can get to your website for Howling Dog Press and to perhaps purchase the book, Cost of Freedom?
Yeah, they can. The website's very simple. It's the three W's, howlingdogpress.com. And it has not only Cost of Freedom listed, I believe, on the very front page now, but it also has a number of other books. And I'm going to, in fact, there's going to be one of my books that will be come available probably in the spring, the first one that's actually been published through Howling Dog Press, and it's called Howling at the End of the World. So you can look for that, and you can look for Cost of Freedom. There are entries for both of them there, little descriptions, and, of course, for Cost of Freedom, some incredible testimonies by some very significant figures, you know, in the anti-war and pro-human rights movement here in the United States, including Noam Chomsky and Ralph Nader and Harry Belafonte and Pete Seeger and others. So, yeah, www.howlingdogpress.com.
Michael, thank you very much. Thank you for sharing all that, and we really enjoyed it. And you have a good Thanksgiving, and have a good night.
You too, Mike.
Okay.
Thanks
take
a lot.
Care. Mm-hmm. You betcha.
Bye-bye.
It's not possible to understand the world by looking up at the line of TVs on the front wall of the strip mall exercise room with all the elliptical machines and stationary bicycles. As Alice says, it would be nice if something would make sense for a change. And that is possible, but not by watching TV while you ride a bicycle. There are things you'll need to pay attention to that may at first seem as silly as trying to fit your 50-year-old butt down a rabbit hole. But if you do, you'll learn about things. And if you learn about things, most people will tell you that you're entirely bonkers. But I'll tell you a secret. All the best people are.
Perhaps what is hopeful is that the fight is on. That there are fighters on our side, that there is even an our side for us to be on in this United States of America. And here is something you will not hear from the line of televisions above the elliptical machines and the weights and the power drink vending machine, but it is one of those things you can study and wonder about that might make things make sense for once.
From Douglas Horn. Douglas Horn graduated from the Ohio State University in 1974 with a BA in history. He served as a junior officer in the U.S. Navy for 10 years, followed by 10 more years with the Navy as a civil servant in an anti-submarine warfare program. Horn worked on the staff of the Assassination Records Review Board in Washington, D.C., for the final 3 years of the Review Board's four-year lifespan from August 1995 through September 1998. He was hired as a senior analyst on the military records team and was later promoted to the position of chief analyst for military records. In other words, the head of the military records team. Horn was not only involved in the location and release of U.S. military records on Cuba and Vietnam policy from 1961 through 1964, but he played an integral role in conducting both unsworn interviews and formal depositions of witnesses to and participants in JFK's autopsy at Bethesda Naval Hospital. He was also involved in joint efforts between the ARRB and Kodak to both digitally preserve the photographic images of the autopsy and to conduct an authenticity study of the Zapruder film in the National Archives.
Douglas Horn says, why doesn't the government reopen the Kennedy case? Why doesn't the government admit there was a massive cover-up? Why doesn't it admit the Warren Commission was selling a fairy tale and that the House Committee on Assassination sold a revised version of the same fairy tale? I think the reason the government doesn't take action and hides behind a wall of silence today is because the whole subject is so radioactive that to get involved, there would be nothing but risk, blame, and exposure. If any president of the United States, if you put yourself in their shoes, politicians, senators, congressmen, any chief executive, as soon as they say anything about the Kennedy assassination that would indicate they don't agree with the official version, it would raise a massive uproar. I think that everyone hides behind a wall of silence, quite frankly, out of cowardice. The cover-up of this assassination that was implemented in the 1960s by guilty men and by people who knew they were telling lies. But from the mid-1970s on, the cover-up has been perpetuated by cowards, and that's been true since 1978. It's really tragic. People in this country don't need to be protected from the truth. We've had three assassinations in the 60s. Nobody believes the official stories on King, RFK, or JFK. We've had Vietnam, we've had Watergate, we've had Iran-Contra, and we had the lies about the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. We don't need to be protected from the truth. We can handle the truth. If we can learn from the truth, we can move forward with confidence and try to prevent those things from happening again. But you're not ever going to find anyone in the U.S. government who wants to do anything with this case ever again.
In South Africa, they had truth commissions. People told the truth after apartheid was over. And at least people came to understand their own history a little bit better. They, these people in the United States who really know the truth about all that's happened, they can't tell the truth because then nobody would pay their taxes. Nobody would care about the military budget anymore, and everybody would be thrown out of office. We have a government that changes hands on the surface every 4 years and every 2 years and every 6 years. But which in reality isn't that much different from the previous one and is still pursuing the same interests at the expense of the needs of people. In the long run, we'd be better for it. We would be more a mature country, more understanding country, better able to safeguard ourselves in the future if we knew exactly what went down in 63 and 68, and the government would fess up to it, and we could examine it and study it in detail. We'd be much better off in the long run because then we could move forward confidently and try to prevent such abuses in the future. Only in that way can we recover our respect as a people and move forward much wiser and more confident about where we should be heading in the future. That's from Douglas Horn.
Hey, hey, you're up, you're up. Someone hollered at Johnny, sitting on the ground against the priest's garage while the rest of his team took their turns kicking. Sister Mark served as permanent pitcher for both teams today. Mark's cheeks gleamed rosy red, framing a wide smile. She had tied her black shawl around her waist, and her black gloves were cut off at the knuckles. She pounded the white ball in her hands. Johnny continued to play in the dirt, messing with the ants, naming them, watching what they did, where they went, who they associated with, while he doodled in the dirt with a stick, making pictures of space alien ships, my favorite Martian little antennas and laser beams, and Moses and the burning bushes. Johnny imagined being one of those ants down there working hard, finding this one twig like it was a golden twig, the twig of all time, pulling that twig around all day long, thinking there must be something special to be done with this amazing twig, and just looking and looking and nobody telling him nothing. "Who's up?" Sister hollered out, breath puffs hanging in the air above her head like cartoon dialogue boxes. "Who's up? Let's go!" She pointed at Johnny with his behind turned toward her on his knees with both hands on the bricks, pushing and grabbing to stand, trying to whistle the intro music to the Andy Griffin Show. Johnny found his way up and shuffled up to take his turn at bat. He stepped up to the rubber mat home plate on the blacktop and backed up three long steps. "Come on!" someone yelled. Why does he always have to do that? He just stands against the door. Jeez. Johnny pressed his heels against the white garage door. Sister leaned over and wrapped the ball in her left hand and arm. She shuffled and slid like a bowler. At the end of her release, she flicked her wrist. The ball spun as it headed toward Johnny, clunking toward the ball in his snow boots, buckles clattering. He saw the ball and opened his eyes wide and tucked his tongue into the corner of his mouth. He clenched his hands and extended his arms like a field goal kicker. He drew his leg back and kicked at it just as the ball turned right. Johnny looked up at the pigeon club swooping over the school. He held out his arms like a blue whale pigeon. He cracked the small of his back on the blacktop as Sister whipped around and slapped hands with her sycophant first base girl. "Missed it by a mile," someone said. Johnny wanted to play for the Yankees, and here he was sitting on his butt on the playground with Sister Mark chewing confiscated fruit-striped gum, maybe his gum, glaring at him, just a dumb little kid. While he sat there, Johnny locked eyes with the third baseman, the fourth-grade boy who had given him the 14 cents to find his Mickey Mantle card. "Get up," the boy yelled at Johnny. With her head down, Sister towed the pitcher's rubber green chalk mark on the blacktop. With one hand, she caught the ball, fired back to her from the catcher on Johnny's team. Johnny heard giggling, "Come on, let's go, we want a bat too." Johnny rolled over to push off to stand. He returned to his place, his heels against the white garage door. "Johnny Moon, come on, Johnny, hit it out here," someone said. Sister coiled into her stance and began her approach. Johnny shuffled fast toward the ball. The ball took a screwball turn. Johnny sat on his hands in a haze. The third time, Sister deigned to make giant slow-motion gestures, showing that she wasn't doing anything strange with the ball, and Johnny took a giant lunge kick and popped out at Weekly to the second sacker, wearing a blue plaid skirt, black shoes, white blouse, and bright red button-down sweater. Moonshot, not. Johnny sat down on the blacktop against the garage. He stretched out his legs with his giant snowshoes pointing straight up. He put up his left hand in front of him like a partial parenthesis and placed the middle finger of his other hand just inside the parentheses to show the second base person.
In the classroom, after the coats and hats and boots were put away and the last of the outside-type stories told, the third-grade boys and girls found their desks and began to steel themselves for what was to come, a whole afternoon of English, arithmetic, and vocabulary. Sister Mary Michael hit her mark in the center of the room in front of the class, between them and the blackboard. Sister Something, the principal, appeared miraculously in the doorway. Her brown robes gracefully just skimmed the floor. She folded her arms at her waist, each arm presumably tucked into the opposite sleeve where Kleenex and absconded magic markers and matchbox cards were also stored. Sister Mary Michael hustled over like a ball player to a coach who whispered. The children fidgeted, turning around to talk, poking someone in back of them with a pencil. Sister Mary Michael turned toward the class, her head down, her hands folded together. She slid back to the door when Sister Principal Something stuck her head back in and held her arm out with a fistful of Kleenex. "For the girl," she said. Nodded toward the class. Sister Mary Michael found her spot directly under the clock above the chalkboard. It said 12:40. She looked up to the class. She had red, shiny eyes, and her nose was running. She wiped tears away with her wad of Kleenex. The children tried to figure out what was wrong. Maybe some kid and his family had been killed in a car accident. Maybe this morning's mass didn't count because of Johnny Moon, and they were all getting venial sins for missing mass on a weekday. Maybe bowling wouldn't be held next month.
But for sure, Sister was crying in public, in class, and they grew nervous like horses in a barn with a tornado headed their way. "Class, girls and boys," she said. She took a deep breath, which they could tell because her robes moved. "The president has been shot." Oh, the class sat with eyes and mouths wide open, staring hard at Sister. Then to each other, "What? What did she say? The president? The president?"
Sister, Sister fell to her knees on the hardwood floor, found her rosary, crossed herself, and began, "In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit." Each child slid out of their desk to kneel on the right side. Each folded their hands and bowed their head to just touch the tip of their noses with the tip of their index fingers. Jimmy Purple slid off the left side of his desk, putting him right next to a girl he liked and refused to yield. Sister led the class in the sorrowful mysteries of the rosary. She then pulled and pushed herself up by one of the front row desks and stumbled over to her desk. She disappeared behind the statue of St. Michael the Archangel that the other nuns had given her on her last feast day.
They heard Dave in the hallway through a crack in the door left by the principal talking about whether to bring in radios or TVs to the classrooms and where they would get them and whether the cords would reach. "We're all going to die," someone whispered. "There will be nuclear war. Nice knowing you. The communists did it. It's because of the Beatles and Castro. Oh, brother. We'll never go to the moon now, so forget that." A girl at a front desk turned and stuck her whole body into the aisle to look at Johnny Moon. "We never were," said someone else. At the same time, the boys and girls realized they would soon be rounded up by Russian soldiers and made to line up in the playground and say, "There is no God." A boy and a girl shot from their desks and ran to the windows to stand on their tiptoes and pull themselves up by the ledge to try to see down onto the street and up into the sky. Sister wiped her nose and began to ask them to please return to their seats, then asked them if they could see anything.
Johnny Moon curled his toes inside his shoes, clenched his hands into Kung Fu general fists. "We choose to go to the moon," Johnny whispered, "and the other things." He couldn't believe he was doing this. "Not because it is easy, but because it is hard." Johnny pushed himself out of his desk to his knees. The children turned their heads into the aisle to see. Johnny flexed his fat hands and placed them flat on the wood floor. With the back of his hand, he swept away some of the dirt and playground mud. He leaned over his hands and stretched back his legs to stand on his tiptoes. He kicked out his legs and shook them out like a sprinter getting ready for a race, the way Coach Isom had showed him. He checked the back of his pants and gave a yank to make sure he didn't moon everyone like he had done once during an exercise with Coach that one day. He took a deep breath, let himself down. "Johnny Moon can't do a push-up," one of the boys said.
Johnny's face glowed radish red and his hands turned whiter. His arm shook as he brought his nose down to just touch the wooden floor. He exhaled and pushed up. His legs shook. "Not because they are easy, but because they are hard," he said in a rush as he reached the top and held it. Again, Johnny let himself down and pushed himself up, and again, as the other children watched him with their mouths open. Jimmy Purple and Michael Irish plopped to the floor, their joints cracking, and began doing push-ups, their behinds high in the air like cows rising. Sister Mary wiped her eyes with the tail of her headdress, pushed off from her desk, and walked to the front of the room. She stared down at the three boys on the floor. She stretched out her arms and dropped to the floor like a cliff diver, smacking her hands on the tile and began doing push-ups, pausing on one arm to throw her veil out of her eyes. The children flooded the aisles, began kicking each other to have enough room and stepping on each other's hands to have enough room and farting on accident and then on purpose in order to have enough room to do push-ups. A few minutes later, they all sat in the aisles, breathing hard. Sister Mary Michael sat with her back against the front wall, her legs bent upward, both hands clutching her rosary, staring out the windows at nothing. They heard amplified noise coming from the brown box intercom above the cloakroom. First, they heard messing with papers and a loud thud and a chair scooting and whispering. Then they heard Father's voice and Sister Principal something, as if they were arguing. "In the name of our Lord Jesus Christ," that was Father. "Please, silence," that was Sister. And then a couple of frantic whispers back and forth. "President John F. Kennedy has died. Let us pray." And the principal began leading them in the rosary. Sister Mary Michael and the children willed themselves again into kneeling position on the floor and followed along on the Hail Marys.
When we started this radio show in February of 2011, we were produced by Len Osanek of Black Op Radio. We stayed with him for about a year and a half and then moved over here to Blog Talk Radio, where we do our own producing and save ourselves a little bit of money that way. But we had a great time with Len. We learned a lot. And We also learned from his show, Black Op Radio. Len is one of the people that knows the most about JFK assassination research. And tonight, we're proud to welcome him as a guest on our show.
Len, I'm so glad to have you on our show as a full-fledged guest for a change. You've appeared on the show a few times, but you were half guest and half producer because you put together the show for us for the first year and a half of its existence. Anyway, welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show.
Well, hello, Chuck. Glad to be back, and I'm glad to speak to either you or Mike anytime.
Well, I'm sure that we'll want to do it maybe a little more often.
You know, okay. Well, I guess you're calling today to discuss that November 22nd is the anniversary of JFK's assassination.
That's exactly right. It's the 49th anniversary this year. Seems like a long time, but sometimes it feels like it was just yesterday. Do you think that we're getting any closer to finding the truth of what happened on that day?
I would say to you that optimistically we are getting closer with every revelation. And compared to what people knew in 1963, all they had is doubt about the Warren Commission, that there was only a lone gunman, and somehow Alan Dulles was there to put everybody back to bed saying there's nothing wrong here, we haven't found anything. Only been more and more revelations that exonerate Lee Oswald as a lone gunman. And the proof is lacking and just not there that he shot anyone that day. He was, as he said and claimed, a Nazi. And I think the more people look into it, the more authors and researchers of exposing what has already been there, you know, almost its view in some areas, that there's been a massive cover-up, a deception has been played over the people of America and perpetrated over also the people of the world who cared about that kind of optimism that John Kennedy had, vision from a new frontier. I think that the old boy network of the Eisenhower era, with all his generals, had said that never were there PhDs in the Pentagon and the White House, because Kennedy brought, quote, the whiz kids with him, the best and the brightest, you know. And that was what was optimistic about Kennedy and his administration, this visionary thinking and thinking on behalf of America and then the world. You know, saying to other leaders, we breathe the same air, we drink the same water, we have to start getting along. And he went up against a continual war machine and the big money that finances that and keeps these wars going. And he was removed by his enemies, I believe. And Lee Oswald was not one of his enemies.
Well, I'm inclined to agree with you. Can you tell us a little more about the proof and also how you have ended up becoming one of the, arguably one of the most knowledgeable authorities on this over the years?
Well, I will give you the background of myself is that I had an interest in the assassination, and I wrote to a retired colonel in the American military, Colonel Fletcher Prouty. And over about a 10-year span, we became good friends, and he illuminated and educated me how ways the world worked, how the Pentagon, how big money handled things. So I became fluent with Fletcher's perspective of things, his 23-year military career, and his 9 years in the Pentagon. Now, saying that, I kind of learned it from the horse's mouth. I mean, Fletcher was there. He worked there. He knew these people. He was so high up that he never had to sign an oath of secrecy. And if you watch the Oliver Stone film, Donald Sutherland played a character called X that was based on Fletcher Prouty.
Oh.
So here was a Pentagon insider who knew how things worked, and he was illuminating to Jim Garrison, Kevin Costner in the film, that here's how these guys have moved, and they used some of their military deception and games that was in other governments. They've been doing it for years. So when he saw a picture of a General Ed Lansdale in Dean Plaza, he said, aha, the old team. So I know those guys moving around the chessboard around the world. So here when Ed Lansdale's in Dealey Plaza, he saw a picture of him. you know, that was enough for him. And he was able to, I think, thoroughly speak about the assassination. I had an interest in that because I pushed the CD-ROM for Fletcher, and I was running his website, and subsequently he's passed away now, so I continued that. But after he passed away, I thought I would do something with knowledge I have acquired, and I continued by interviewing other people on a show, Black Op Radio. I've been doing that for about 12 years, and we talk about the assassinations of the 60s, you know, ramifications. So any filmmaker, author, you know, things like that, a researcher, I have on weekly to investigate that topic. And I can say that it's surprising how new information keeps coming forward. And the information does not support in any way the Warren Commission, the findings of the Warren Commission. In fact, delving down into what the Warren Commission discovered, you'd be surprised by the evidence that's there. That does, it goes to the face of their conclusion of a lone gunman. So if you find a narrow bandwidth of American history interesting, at Black Op Radio, you'll find a lot of that. I think that answers your question kind of quickly.
I think so. You know, you're a Canadian. How did you end up getting so interested and in the assassination? What led you to talk to Prouty in the first place?
What led me to write to Fletcher was the fact that I had this interest in what might have been the world's greatest murder mystery. I don't think, you know, anybody, reasonable intelligence actually thought that that bullet, Commission's Exhibit 399, I mean, the whole story, you don't have to get into it now, but they thought something's wrong. I don't think that I did it. Well, then who did? And this is like the greatest Sherlock Holmes book, right? You know, someone killed the president in high noon in a big city in Texas, right? You know, and they got away with it. And it seemed apparent to everyone that they got away with it. So when I heard a few lectures of Fletcher and different interviews, I work in a recording studio, and you'd be surprised that if I listen to bands, you know, noon till midnight, 12-hour days, when I get in the car drive home, I don't turn on more music. I know it sounds funny, but I can just tell you, one summer I worked in a pizza place over the summer. By the end of the summer, I hated pizza.
Yeah.
No, you want pizza? No, I'm sick of it. So when you listen to music all day long, you want something different. I listened to political lectures on the way home. I had a friend who lived in Los Angeles who would mail me some of the Michael Parente or different people or Dave Emery, Mae Brussel, and early researchers that had things on cassettes. And when I heard Fletcher Prouty speak, just a different thing altogether. It was not a researcher. It was someone who was there and very, you know, very precise, telling you this is what went on in these meetings. And the chiefs of staff, I know I was there. And you hear that ring of truth if you listen to any of his lectures. And, you know, compared to a lot of other people, say, well, I have an opinion, and this is my theory, or this is what my research has shown, you know, based on the documents that I've been able to pry out from a Freedom of Information Act. But I think Fletcher working in the Pentagon from 1955 to 1964, that was enough that he was right at the hub of that activity, of the CIA blossoming out and then all of a sudden having the rug pulled out from under with Alan Dulles being fired for continually misrepresenting the standing in that.
So
I think just meeting Fletcher and having him know these things are matter of fact, It made me want to delve into Fletcher's history, produce a CD-ROM for him, and learn as much as I could from him. The only other person might have been Bob McNamara then, and he wasn't really talking too much. But it's amazing the details that Fletcher was able to discuss with me and reveal to anyone who was interested to listen.
From the time period that he was in the Pentagon, most of that is before the assassination. Were there other operations in other countries that had a similar MO, as it were?
Well, they go on every day. So Fletcher was the liaison officer between the Air Force and the CIA, and he was very high up, one of the top 53 people in the Pentagon of 35,000 at that time. So I'm just saying he was high up there, and it's just my good luck that I wrote him a very good letter to start the ball rolling by saying, I'm a musician. I work in a recording studio in Vancouver, Canada. I'm not a writer. I'm not in the military. I don't have any grudge against the CIA. I just am an interested person wondering about the world we live in and how things work, and can you perhaps answer some of these questions? And writing that letter, I spent about 6 months crafting it. I think that once I had decided, oh, I'm going to write this Colonel Prouty a letter. Now, if I ever met anyone who really knew who killed Kennedy, what would I ask him? And I'll try to arrange it like this. The who killed Kennedy will be the center of the wheel, but all the questions will be like the spokes. So if I ask enough questions, I won't really have to ask who killed Kennedy. Because I'd heard in one interview before, he didn't like that when somebody just walks up and says, okay, who killed him, right? You know, and you,
right.
And you say, oh, it was Ed Lansdale. You know, and what? what does that mean? No one knows what that means, right?
Uh-huh.
You know, well, who does Ed Lansdale work? Well, he worked for Alan Dulles. Well, who does Alan Dulles work for? Well, he worked for Sullivan Cromwell, but he was also the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. And Fletcher many times had told me the most important letter in that name was the A, CIA, agency.
Hmm.
It says, that agency works for a client, much like a lawyer at a law firm is working for the client. Who is the client? Everybody assumes it's just the Department of Defense.
Hmm.
But do they work for their old retired generals that are now the board of directors of this or that company? Are they in Bell Helicopter? What are these guys investing in? And where is this big money coming from? So that's kind of a longer topic, but you know, briefly, it had a lot of interest for me, and I met someone who actually knew what was going on. And I might say that Fletcher didn't just open up to me the first letter I wrote. He was impressed with the letter, and we got along very good. It took about 4 years before some of my research struck a nerve with him, and he said, you know, oh, now I realize that you're really listening to everything I'm talking about. Here I'm going to start faxing you some documents. And then my fax machine was running almost day and night, and I got so much information, I thought, well, I can pay him back by maybe organizing this, that I'm fluent with computers, and I made a CD-ROM, the collected works of Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, and then that got the ball rolling, and we were doing radio interviews together, and then he became ill, and once we weren't doing this together, I thought, well, I know the topic so well, I might as well just do my own show, and I'll discuss the Kennedy assassination, you know, Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, with authors and filmmakers and people who know the topic, rather than going on just any AM radio station that wanted to talk about it, because the host generally wasn't that fluid in this topic, you know, fluent. So sometimes it's complicated. You get people that are in denial. They don't think some of these things are going on. And, you know, you kind of asked, is this thing still going on? Well, yes, it is. And there's many operations, but we wouldn't have time to talk about them now. But, you know, on YouTube, a lot of documentaries are out there available.
Yes, it seems to be increasing at a rapid rate, the amount of information that's available.
Yeah, and the ability to network, the ability to listen to one author or filmmaker that you might not have ever heard of, and then go, I'm going to listen to that guy, or who's this Leno Sanek? I'm going to look him up.
Yeah.
Or who was that Colonel Prouty? And before you know it, you're finding pages and pages on someone.
Well, in closing, I would like you to tell our listeners where they can find Black Op Radio, where they can find the CD you made, and the archive recordings, and anything else that you want to publish.
Sure. It's very easy. The one website is blackopradio.com. If you go to Black Op Radio, all one word, you'll find everything. But if you remember the name Fletcher Prouty, Colonel Fletcher Prouty, it's prouty.org. www.prouty.org. Or I'm sure if you know, search Leno Sanek or Prouty or Black Op Radio, you'll find different links and matching links. And I would say that even as this is November 22nd, it's still important to remember the good things that President Kennedy did and his vision for the future, and a future for the world. And it is an education to discover what happened in that investigation of his murder. And, you know, there was not a lone gunman, and Lee Oswald was what he said he was, a patsy. Mm-hmm. And I think people are somehow still uncomfortable with that fact. Maybe not listeners to your show, but people want to think, oh, there was just one guy and he got a lucky shot and that was it. Thank goodness, right?
Hmm. Yeah, right. They'd like it to be that way. Len, thank you so much for coming back on our show, and we'll definitely want to talk to you in a few months.
Okay, no problem. Call anytime.
Thank you, and good night.
Thank you.
Occupy Dealey Plaza. That's where it all began, November 22nd, 1963, about 12:30 p.m. 50 years ago, on November 22nd, 2013, filled Dealey Plaza with protesters and signs and singing and speaking, and let them bring their dogs and their cops and their robbers and murderers and their sniper rifles and double secret video cameras and microphones.
Occupy Dealey Plaza. We demand a truth commission to replace the Warren Commission and the 9/11 Commission. We want freedom. We want peace. We want real hope and real change.
Occupy Dealey Plaza. Let them know we know what they have done. Occupy Dealey Plaza. Let the world know this is America.
This interview was conducted at the Hungry Eye in San Francisco on Monday, March 18th, between the Argo newspaper and American comedian Mort Saul.
I just want to make an addition there. It was conducted in the 1960s. This is the Argo newspaper. Why is the truth behind the assassination of President Kennedy the last chance of America for its survival?
Mort Saul, because the evidence developed by District Attorney Garrison indicates that certain people had to take President Kennedy's life in order to control ours. There's been a great change in this country since Kennedy. I'm afraid a great deal of our hope was interred with his remains.
What is the long, hard night that America must go through that you've spoken of?
She has to hang on through a period of the military and the CIA with a blank check, trying to sell fascism. If she can hang on long enough, Americans may yet live in the country in which they were born. And that's the country structured by Tom Paine and Tom Jefferson.
What is the renaissance following this long, hard night that you've also spoken about?
We'll start pursuing the American dream again. I don't know if we'll ever realize it, but we're supposed to have the right to pursue it. And the renaissance will be that a groundswell of public opinion will flush out the rascals. Because the CIA has infiltrated every area of our national life. I'm afraid that the country they subverted the best was the United States.
What is the extent of the conspiracy, and why is the government so desperate to keep the truth from the American public?
We've determined that elements of the Central Intelligence Agency planned the execution and killed the president. We later find Oswald saying, "I was a patsy," in the Dallas police station.
What will make the American people face themselves and, to use your expression, rise up like an army?
Well, they have very decent instincts. If they didn't, the government would not have to hide the facts from them. And so once the truth is revealed to them, they're no longer under a cloak of ignorance. Public opinion will change things. There will be a groundswell. But it is evident now, if they will kill a president, they'll go to any lengths not to be toppled. And they are so embedded in the society. Presidents are almost transient. The only president that ever went up against them was Kennedy. And we see what happened to him for his pains. It's a sick society, and that's really the crux. That's why Garrison says this case is the crux of whether this country goes on or not. Is it an open society? Can the government tell you we know better what's good for you than you know?
Well, it's been a long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. Solomon Sendak, an unknown Mount Liberty rider, took off, well, last spring already in his green 76 Pontiac Bonneville on a tour around the country to sell his books, which he has self-published, and not even his wife or children know about the books, even though on several occasions he has told them that he has given all rights to his books and proceeds to them in his will. They just look up for a moment and grin and say, "Oh, Daddy," and go back to their phones. Solomon Sendak sent back accounts of his travels in columns he wrote for the local newspaper. He sent them by email, and they did not get printed. And when he returned and went to ask about that, the editor agreed to put them up now on the newspaper website in the local crime section whenever there is room.
I love talking about Kennedy, which is down in Dallas, Texas. You know, you can go down there to Dealey Plaza, where Kennedy was assassinated. You can actually go to the sixth floor of the school book depository. It's a museum called the Assassination Museum. I think they named it after the assassination. Anyway, they have the window set up to look exactly like it did on that day, and it's really accurate, you know. Oswald's not in it. You can't actually get to the window as such, but the reason they did that, of course, is they don't want thousands of American tourists going there each year and saying, "No way, I can't even see the road. My shit, they're lying to us. There's no way." Bill Hicks. Anybody here seen my old friend John? Weatherford, Texas. I'd hope to make it to Stephenville tonight, but it's midnight and I'm about an hour or more short. Stephenville's where there have been a recent rash of UFO sightings. I'll go outside and smoke a cigarette and look around. It's the best I can do. I'm here, UFOs. Abduct me! Thursday night, I met with the Dallas-Fort Worth 9/11 Truth Group at Crystal's Pizza. Daniel and Dale are from Dallas. They're jailers in Dallas County Jail. I mentioned the old jail being in Dealey Plaza, how some inmates said they saw a shooter in the sixth floor window. Daniel says it's closed now. They used to hold hangings on the roof. He says former inmates of the jail and older jailers say it's haunted because of that. Dale is big and bald. He'll be 21 soon. He's from Arizona. His dream would be to get onto the Dallas Police Force, become a resource officer in the schools.
This morning I went to Mecca. I don't think being in Bethlehem could be any more awe-inspiring than where I was today. Maybe a John Prine concert. Dealey Plaza, 411 Elm Street.
The first day I walked into kindergarten at Lincoln School, Miss Steele had written all across the blackboard in big, fluffy, yellow teacher handwriting, "President John F. Kennedy." Third grade, just after lunch, Sister Ellen floated into the classroom on that invisible nun conveyor belt and told us the president had been shot and that he was dead.
Why, I asked Mike Brown, who is standing on the grassy knoll, why he comes here. "For the truth," says Mike. He's a big black man wearing black work clothes. He's got a deep voice, and he's giving folks the alternative view of history, the op-ed of what they have just heard nearby in the JFK Museum tour. He has been coming to this place ever since that day, forever, to tell the truth. What is the truth? Everyone ran here, he says, meaning the grassy knoll. You could smell the gunpowder. He didn't see any shooters when he arrived, but he pulls out a black and white photo of a man in a suit and a white cowboy hat behind a fence, carrying something under a jacket or a cover that Mike says is a rifle. There is a police officer in the photo. Mike knows him, shows the two together in a recent color photo. The police officer says the man told him he was with the Secret Service and should keep the crowd that was coming up to the fence area away, which the officer then did. The man disappeared.
Mike was 13 in 1963. He shows a color photo of himself in the crowd on Elm Street. Skinny kid in a red and white checkered shirt. Wide eyes, leaning forward to see the oncoming motorcade in front of the Daltex building. He later testified in front of the Warren Commission when it came to Dallas.
It's small, tiny. So much in so little space. It's like finding out World War II actually took place in the high school gym. The shot from the grassy knoll was point blank. There is an X in the middle lane of the road.
The road angle is downwards. The grassy knoll fence is still there. Right there is the overpass where the car disappeared into history, with Jackie Kennedy climbing onto the back of the vehicle to retrieve part of her husband's brain.
I walk around to look over the fence. I would be too short to be a shooter, but you realize that the shot was point blank. It's all just right there. The train whistle blows. Behind there are the tracks, the overpass. Mike says it's all just as it was then. The fence is the same. He points to the perch where Abraham Zapruder stood with his camera. It's right there, just a few feet away.
This hasn't all been a dream. It's real. On the back of the fence, people have written their names, dedications to the president. St. John Hunt was here, son of E. Howard Hunt, 11308. JFK, God bless you. George Bush did it, 9/11 truth.
Inside the museum, they give you headphones and you go up the elevator to the sixth floor. You walk around the parts of the exhibit listening to the audio tour. You learn about the Kennedy presidency and also about the mood in Dallas before his visit, during his visit. You see amateur film of the event, still photos. The crowds were 10 deep along Main Street. You look out those windows on the sixth floor, down Houston Street where the motorcade came before turning sharply left. There are people all around the area taking photos, pointing toward the sixth floor. A group now is gathered out on the grassy knoll. New carpeting, new shiny displays, but the wooden beams and big steel braces are the same. You can touch them. Lean against them, feel them. It's family history, genealogy. We want to know where we came from. It's not like going to see some World War I battlefield. It's now. There are people alive now who know the truth, who were there. It's a cold, open case. On the Lincoln School 7th grade history textbook timeline of world history, it's still the same day.
It's mostly quiet in the museum because people are walking around with earphones listening to the audio tour. But it's also quiet from intensity, like folks are walking in to view the body of a close friend. When they actually get there, perhaps more than they can handle. I'd meant to walk around in the neighborhood behind the depository where Oswald ran or walked to get away. But in the tour, they say he walked out the front door, took a bus, then a transfer, then a cab, then walked to get home in the Oak Cliff neighborhood, change clothes, get his gun, then supposedly kill Officer J.D. Tippit, and then try to hide in the Texas Theater on Jefferson Boulevard, where he was captured by the Dallas police.
Mike points back over the trees to the double McDonald's arches in the distance and says, that's where Kennedy was supposed to be going to speak at a luncheon at the Market Hall. He was just a few minutes from there. I ask why Oswald ran. Mike says he didn't run. He just went home to get his gun. Tippit was supposed to kill him. Oswald was the patsy. Maybe he realized at that moment what was happening to him.
Oswald sounds calm on the earphones, saying he didn't kill anybody. You stand there in the spot and hear those words. I can't see myself being that cool. I get lost leaving the area as a matter of course, go along an overpass, find myself in Oak Cliff. This is where Oswald lived, where Tippit was shot, where the theater is. It's now a black neighborhood. I bet it was white middle class back then. I make a wrong turn, almost hit a white car. Black woman screams and honks. I mouth, sorry, head back toward downtown. Mike says that Tippit was supposed to kill Oswald, the patsy, and that Ruby had to be called in to clean up the job. But who shot Tippit then? Why? I can't help but wonder what it would have been like to be Oswald at that time, to be boarding that bus, running with all this happening around him, walking along a normal city street, knowing his life would never be okay ever again. Well, I go all the way through the downtown, along Commerce, finally find Main Street, and realize this is the motorcade route, right here. I'm on it, and it will take me back to Dealey Plaza. Here it is. I pass the spot at the curb where Mike stood in 1963. Here I go down the dip. There's Mike on the grassy knoll with another group pointing up to the Daltex rooftop, where he says one of the shooters was, along with two behind the fence and one more on the sixth floor. Not Oswald, Mike told me. Mike has never left Dealey Plaza. He never will. I'm exiting soon, with President John F. Kennedy still etched into my brain in flaky yellow chalk. And then, boom, there I am, on the X. The knoll is right there. There's the overpass. I turn right to take 35E. In a few moments, I pass Market Hall, where Kennedy was supposed to speak at a luncheon. Then a few moments later, the exit for Love Airfield, where the Kennedys landed just before noon that day, and where they left later in the day with the president's body in a box.
And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO high school history teachers are about average.
And that wraps up another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We hope you'll join us back here again next week, same time, same place. We'd like to thank World News Trust .com for providing our website. We'd like to thank June2508.com and thespiritualun.org for helping to sponsor our show. And thank you, Mike, and good night.
Good night, Chuck. Stay warm. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.